Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I thought I'd start out telling you about something I've become, you know, more and more aware of over the last couple of years as a medical problem, and yet it's one that kind of is flying under the radar for most doctors. If you talk to a doctor and you say the words histamine, they're immediately like, oh yeah, allergies, antihistamine, yeah, and they can list all the drugs, both the trade name and the chemical name and the dosing, because, hey, that's what we do. But really, when you get right down to it, that's only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to histamine. And there are a number of ways that people, besides having allergies release histamine in their system, can end up with histamine overload. And I think it's much more common than we used to think. And I'm wondering whether a lot of those people who get migraines and their migraine triggers are high on the list of histamine overload. I've recently encountered several patients who had, you know, what was clearly an allergic reaction to food, but yet tested negative on all the skin testing. There's also a form of food poisoning that looks like an anaphylactic attack. It's called scromboid poisoning. And what happens in this particular kind of poisoning is that bacteria get into fish. These are usually big fish, like the kind you might see in Hawaii, you know, mahi-mahi and et cetera, but it can also be in other fish, particularly smoked fish. And what happens is that the bacteria actually change the histidine, that's with a D, into histamine with an M in your gut. That pesky microbiome is at it again. This can also happen spontaneously in people's guts. You may have heard about the guy who, well, you might have heard my program where I mentioned the story of the fellow who was pulled over for drunk driving, and it turned out that he had alcohol being made by his gut as it fermented carbohydrates, and he actually had not been drinking. It had just been absorbing from his intestinal wall. Well, anyway, getting back to histamine, it's not just about allergies. It's a molecule that's involved in immunity, the removal of allergens, of course, but it also helps with digestion. It's important for the release of stomach acid. And it's also released spontaneously in response to injury and toxins. I already mentioned it can be made by bacteria in the gut, but it's also present in certain foods. There are some genes and some genetic variations that make you much more subject to histamine overload. And we're going to be talking about that in a few minutes. But you may just have histamine-like reactions to food because you're not able to break down histamine rapidly. And the symptoms may not be hives or itching, although they can be. One patient of mine gets a big flash of sudden fatigue, and then she gets burning and itching in her skin, but no hives and nothing visible. And then she gets a migraine the next day, or a bad headache, which has the characteristics of a migraine. So other people have reported dizziness, and I've seen sudden abdominal cramping and diarrhea from the consumption of these high histamine foods. So I want to talk about what would be high histamine foods, because if you react to these things with any of those symptoms, you might want to get yourself checked. We'll talk about the genetic testing in a little while, but let's talk about the foods. First of all, egg whites, but not egg yolks. Egg yolks actually are beneficial, which is kind of weird. They actually help break down histamine, but the egg whites contain histamine. Maybe that's why the yolks break it down. Many types of fish, soy sauce, aged cheese, smoked meats, some nuts, canned, pickled, and fermented products in general, but also some vegetables. There's a fair amount of histamine in tomatoes and in spinach. Yogurt has some histamine in it, as does buttermilk and kefir. So these healthy foods that we think about may actually cause problem. Sourdough bread, we all got into that during 2020. I thought it seemed like everybody was baking bread. And fermented soy products, and that would be miso, soy sauce, natto, sauerkraut and kimchi, sardines and tuna especially, and kombucha. So lots of things contain histamine, and you'll want to think about if you're getting headaches or any of the symptoms I've mentioned, could it be a histamine overload? Certainly, if you ate three or four of these things in a meal, you might cross your threshold. Now, there are foods that lower histamine. Some of these are supplements, luteolin, quercetin, a compound called camphorol, which is found in dill, oregano, and onions, green peppers, apples, capers, green beans, and juniper berries. So I'm not suggesting that you have a shot of gin with your fermented fish, but maybe that would work. And certainly, it's good to know that there are foods that lower it. I personally am very big on quercetin because it is excellent, not just for lowering histamine, but for stabilizing hay fever and asthma. And I use that in combination with certain probiotics, and I'm often able to prevent people from having to take pharmaceuticals. As I mentioned, egg yolks break down histamine or speed up the breakdown of it, but also mangoes, coconuts, poultry, grapes, figs, cabbage, and basil, rosemary, and broccoli. So a lot of the foods that I eat all the time, I'm happy to say, and maybe that's why my allergies haven't been so bad. Actually, I think that's the quercetin. There are also some other things that are really beneficial for reducing histamine. Those are supplements. Zinc, copper, vitamin C, B6, all help. Bentonite clay and zeolite can be helpful because they absorb the histamine in the gut. Berberine, which I use for my diabetics and my high cholesterol patients sometimes, if I can't get them down with my usual methods, and wild oregano oil. I think we already talked about oregano, so those are good supplements. But what about the genes? Do I need to have this information? Well, there are two really important genes involved in the breakdown of histamine. One of them is called histamine N-methyltransferase, and the other one is called D-amino acid oxidase. So we'll start with the histamine N-methyltransferase. Yes, you heard that. You've heard me talk about methyl. This is a methylation process. It transfers a methyl group from SAMe, that's S-adenosylmethionine, and you can buy that at the store if you want to improve your methylation. If you're exposed to a lot of environmental toxins, improving your methylation is a great way to protect yourself from cancer induced by the environmental toxins and also get rid of them and get them out of your body. It works very well, this histamine N-methyltransferase, in the bloodstream, and it's also very important in the airway. So people who have mutations in this gene maybe have a little bit less effective breakdown of histamine, and it's a risk factor for the airway complications, which is to say runny nose, sneezing, and of course asthma, and also for the rash and the hives. D-amino acid oxidase is very important in the gut. And people who have a low level of this because of one of two different mutations, they have decreased activity. They have a normal level, I should say, but they have a decreased level of efficiency or effectiveness of this enzyme. It is probably the most important cause of histamine intolerance due to the accumulation of histamine in body tissues. So it's also present in the bloodstream. Knowing that you have these mutations involves having your genetics checked. These are commonly looked at. They're part of the raw download for 23andMe, but those of you who have had perhaps 23andMe may want to get that raw download and use one of several internet sites that for a fee can analyze your DNA, and you can look at DAO and HMMT. Another thing you can do is ask your doctor to check your serum histamine level during the time that you're having a reaction. If you're in the middle of that headache or having the hives and your histamine level is high, in your serum, that would indicate it's a histamine reaction and maybe point you in the direction of looking at your HNMT. If your symptoms are more gastrointestinal, you can't really look for DAO, but you can look for the urine metabolite, histamine N-methyltransferase. And so that's the other, that's what the breakdown product is. You can look at a 24-hour urine. These are tests that are available through conventional laboratories. There's also a health food fix, and that's getting DAO as a oral product and taking it when you consume foods that either have a lot of histamine, if you think you accumulate, or when you consume foods that you know give you a headache or a reaction, you can basically see if taking 3 or 4 capsules of DAO with the food actually improves your response to the food or maybe even eliminates the reaction. That would tell you that this is what's going on in a kind of, you know, seat of the pants way, but it doesn't cost you anything like having to get your DNA done. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this information. I really enjoy doing a little science lesson or talking about things you can use at the top of the hour. A while ago, somewhere between 5 to 8 years ago, if I'm recollecting correctly, I came across a book called The Emperor of Scent. I had to look up the author. It's Chandler Burr, B-U-R-R, like a burr in your sock. And I was fascinated because it's the saga of a scientist trying to understand olfactory reception over many, many years. The mystery of how we smell. I've had dogs now for, gosh, a couple of decades, and they live in a world of smell. That is their primary thing. As a highly visual individual, I live in a world of sight. My husband lives in a world of sound. People often have a dominant sensory modality. But dogs all have the same dominant sensory modality, and that's odor. And they have incredible sensitivity, but even bugs have odor sensors. It's the earliest form of sensing of the environment, even before light receptors. Think about that for a second. Chemoreception, how does it work in mammals? Does it work the same way as it does in insects? Stands to reason from an evolutionary standpoint because, well, the insects were here first, and why would nature invent a new method? Turns out that's true. But the book that I was referring to, The Emperor of Scent, really talked about the idea that in order for us to be able to smell the vast number of odors that we can detect, literally millions of different odors out there in the world, we have to be able to have almost a mass spectrometer in our nose. And it turns out we kind of do. Just as a mass spectrometer determines an element on a distant sun, mass spectrometers are chemical composition of objects in their environment, and they're broken down, and you look at a spectrum of lines. Well, that's kind of how this works. The olfactory receptors are amazing. Let's talk about the smells. Coffee. I love that smell. It's 200 different chemical components, each of which is completely structurally different, and none of which actually smell like coffee by themselves. But we only have 100 odor receptors, or maybe 200. So how can 200 receptors work? In our vision, we need only 3 receptors to see all of the possible colors available, because light, what we're seeing, varies in only one variable, and that's the frequency of the light. So with 3 receptors, we can see it all. Of course, we can't see into the infrared or the ultraviolet, but that's because we have limitations in the frequency sensation. Still, it's fascinating. Now, when you talk about odor, hundreds of different molecules creating millions of different odors, and a single smell, like coffee. So many different shapes, so many different sizes of molecules all fusing together to make coffee. This has just been a crazy, crazy dilemma. Most receptors are a shape. When we talk about the genetic receptors on or the receptors on the cell surface. A chemical like estrogen comes along, and you have maybe two or three different kinds of estrogen receptors on different types of tissue. But it's the same molecule, estrogen, and it fits into the receptor in a classic way. Most receptors are very precisely shaped so that they only sense a few molecules, and we spend a lot of time trying to invent new-to-nature molecules that'll fit into the estrogen receptor. That's where birth control pills came from. It turns out that each of the olfactory receptors can bind, of that, let's say, 200, they can bind to many, many different chemical components, and each one of them sends a signal to the brain, okay, I got resonated, I got tapped by this smell. And it's because you have 100 receptors all sending a message, I got a tap, I didn't get a tap. That's where the code for smell comes in. The brain decodes the activation pattern of combinations of receptors. It makes me think a little bit about how we understand sound, right? We have this single vibrating membrane with a whole bunch of nerves, and the nerves effectively are picking up where that membrane is resonating, where the nodes are in the resonance, and that codes for the sound. But we can hear complex sounds. That eardrum of ours is vibrating to an entire symphony, and yet we're able to listen to it and hear the flute and hear the violin and hear the voice of the soloist. Wow, that's just an amazing bit of processing. And smell is just as good. You know what? Our understanding of this was waiting for, it was waiting for our technology to grow up to the point where we could actually look at a receptor and studied what it did and how it behaved. We're finally here. So research just published, came out of Rockefeller University and was published in Nature in the most recent issue, used a technology called cryo-electron microscopy. You take a frozen specimen and you beam electrons at it, and you can see very, very small molecular constructs in 3D. You can get all the way down to the individual atom. So think about Legos and being able to see all the different bricks. And from that, you can watch what it does. It turns out that all of those odor receptors function in the same way. They form what's called an ion channel that opens only when the receptor encounters one of its targets. An ion channel is basically a little portal that charged particles can flow through from the inside of a cell to the outside of the cell. And that charge creates a nerve impulse, which then goes to the brain. So the team then, having looked at that, they picked a couple of odor molecules, and they picked eugenol, which is clove oil, and DEET, the insect repellent, both of which have very distinct
chemical structures.
They found a receptor that will bind to either of those, even though they smell very different. So with their testing devices, they looked at what happened. They looked at how the receptor interacted with the molecule. And this is another controversy. It turns out that both DEET and eugenol bind at the same place, and they fit entirely into a simple pocket within the receptor. But the receptor doesn't bond strongly to odorants like it does with the estrogen receptor or the other receptors that we were expecting. These weak bonds, basically the molecule just kind of bounces around inside the receptor, but it gets in, it's loose, but that allows it to accommodate so many different odor molecules. Not everything can get in. All of these receptors have different sensitivities. Now, insects, which is what they were using here for this study, insects have five or six different receptors, but they're able to smell everything they need. One single mutation in the DNA for the receptor that changes one amino acid will completely shift the suite of odors that that particular receptor can detect. And so you can see how in evolution, insects might find themselves in a different environment and have a novel food which they can't detect. But then there's a mutation, and one insect comes into being that has a mutation that allows it to smell this food. So it goes and eats the food, and now it has an additional food supply. So it's going to reproduce more rapidly, and its progeny inherit that gene. And, well, off we go to the races. It's evolution in action. And it's an amazing, complex, beautiful thing. And we're going to go to our first email. This is from Andrew in Soquel. This is a quick one. Hi, Dr. Don. Some experts describe CoQ10 as an essential supplement. Do you recommend it? What dose, CoQ10 or ubiquinol? I scanned a year's worth of podcast and didn't see it in the episode summaries. Let me just say a little bit about CoQ10. It was first named ubiquinol because it was literally ubiquitous. And one of the most important things that CoQ10 does is it acts as a part of the electron transport chain in the mitochondria. So it allows our mitochondria to function, which allows us to deliver energy to all of our cells in our body. Cyanide turns off the electron transport chain, just stops it dead. Basically, you have about 17 seconds of ATP in your body if all of the electron transport chains were to stop at once. I find that amazing. So just to get a sense for how much energy and how much work these mitochondria are doing to keep us alive, it's astonishing. CoQ10 is literally critical to mitochondrial function. It's an important antioxidant as well, and it acts as a free radical sink. It's good at grabbing those electrons. But it's made by the body. It's made by an enzyme, and that enzyme is present in all of our cells. But we use a drug to lower cholesterol that breaks the enzyme. So people who are using a statin absolutely need to take extra CoQ10 because they aren't going to be able to be as efficient at making their own. And this is an accidental side effect. It's been known since the invention of these drugs, but it was never felt to be important enough to bother telling people. Basically, Merck did not want to admit that there was a downside to their drug. Simple as that. As a result, some of the statin side effects, like the muscle aches, the brain fog that some people experience, this is clearly reversible if you give them CoQ10 at high doses for a couple of weeks and then re-challenge them with a different statin. They can often tolerate it. Not that I necessarily want to do that, because I have other ways besides statins of lowering cholesterol. However, in a pinch, or with someone who's had a heart attack or a couple of them, you know, that person really needs a statin. Their risk-benefit ratio is such that they need the statin, but they do need the CoQ10 with it. And if you are taking a statin, please get some CoQ10, about 300 milligrams of ubiquinol. To respond directly to your question, Andrew, if you're healthy, you can probably make enough on your own. I usually tell people over 50, go ahead and take 100 milligrams of ubiquinol a day as a nutrient to help you deal with free radicals. As we get older, our ability to quench free radicals drops. Our mitochondria take a lot of hits from the environment, even just little cosmic rays bouncing through there, so they're more fragile. And giving them a little extra support is probably a good idea. So I recommend it provisionally. If a person has a really great diet and really great DNA and they take care of themselves, and exercise and all of, you know, check all of the boxes, they're probably fine without it. But as they get older, it's probably a good idea. The emails to On Air, of course, go straight to the head of the line. This one comes from Liz in Pacific Grove. Dear Dr. Don, I have been taking strontium citrate for quite a while, thinking it was helpful for bone density. Recently, I looked it up in Consumer Lab and learned that this particular strontium has not been shown to aid in bone density. Apparently, there's a different strontium that has been shown to be helpful in Europe that's not available in the U.S. And yes, Liz, that was strontium ranulate. And it's, I think, been pulled from many of the European countries after some additional research. Reading on to Liz's question, I further read that people with certain heart issues should probably not be taking it at all, and that it throws off bone density tests using DEXA by about 8 points, making it look like someone's results are better than they actually are, and that this effect can take years to go away even after stopping the strontium citrate. Could you please comment on all this, and what would you recommend taking instead, supplement-wise, to support bone density, if you agree that the supplement is not terribly useful for the purpose? And thank you, Liz. That was a great question. And I think I'll start by saying science marches on. So the original science using strontium ranulate did show an improvement in bone density with a couple of years of use. And it seemed like it was logical that it would be helpful because strontium is incorporated into bone. And we know that there used to be, I think it was strontium 19, but I'm not really sure of the number. But back a long time ago, children, only boomers would remember this. There was something called atmospheric testing of nuclear bombs and atomic bombs. And they would blow them up to make big mushroom clouds and prove to each other that they, you know, had the huevos to blow things up. And then that was supposed to keep everybody safe by something called mutually assured destruction. So people have been crazy for more than just your lifetime, I guess, is my children. I'm my point there. Anyway, so one of the problems was that strontium can be radioactive, and it rained down and it got incorporated into the grass, and then it got incorporated into the cows, and then it got into the milk supply, and it started showing up in the bones of infants, human infants. At that point, they started talking, let's just test underground and not do atmospheric testing, because even though it's really pretty to see what a nice big mushroom cloud I made, my grandchildren with radioactive bones, maybe I don't necessarily want that to happen. So sanity prevailed. But that's what we know about strontium in bones. It took long. It took 10 years after the initial, oh, it improves bone density, to realize that, yeah, it improves bone density, but it doesn't really improve the fracture rate. And the people with the higher bone density who had been taking strontium broke their hips and crushed their spines just about as quickly as they would have if they had not taken the strontium supplement. Thus, it was proved to be ineffective at the thing we were trying to do, protect people's bones, but not very, but quite effective at the thing we were using as our measurement, which is to say, we were using bone density. We changed the bone density, but we didn't make the bones any stronger or more resistant to fracture. It took a while to figure that out. It's just like the problem with the class of drugs for bones called the bisphosphonates. Yes, they prevent the bones from deteriorating. They reduce the rate of risk for fractures. But after about 15 years, you start to get weird fractures in places people don't usually get fractures because it strengthens the bone, but it makes it more brittle. And because the bone isn't able to regenerate itself, it's kind of like frozen in time. I remember a movie called Death Becomes Her. It's a great movie to look up if you've never seen it. It's hilarious. But it's about immortality at the price of becoming very, very brittle. Two very fine actresses, Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep, just a true tour de force. So sorry for the digression, but not really. Hope that answers your question. I don't recommend it. A small amount is often present in Bone-Up. It's present in a bunch of other products. That's not the dose that's going to throw off your DEXA. So I don't really mind people taking those products. 3 milligrams good, 50 milligrams bad is basically my answer on the strontium question. And let's move to our next email. That one is from Lucy in Santa Cruz, and Lucy writes, using incentive inspirometer. I heard your piece on using the incentive inspirometer to lower blood pressure. I have one from a surgery a while back, and I thought I'd give it a go, especially since I've been having some unexplained shortness of breath after mild exertion. Though I notice that it lessens almost to vanishing if I eat much less. Interesting. I've used it for 2 days, and suddenly I have a deep, loud cough, not one of those unstoppable fits, more like an irresistible urge. Is this an expected side effect? Is it harmful? Could it possibly be because the deeper inhalation just brings more dust into my lungs? Door number three, Lucy, I think that your device may have contained contaminants like dust that could have settled inside it. I don't know how long you've had it kicking around. I worry a little bit about deterioration. And also I worry a little bit about some contaminant like mold or bacteria since it did come home from the hospital. So the intention, the devices that were used in the article that I talked to you about were not incentive spirometers. They resemble incentive spirometers. And there was evidence that it improved lung function. It was particularly useful for older people. And so I do recommend using an exercise device to exercise your lung and your diaphragm and your intercostal muscles by sucking in. And the science is solid on that. You can purchase such a device online. You can go to Amazon, or you can, the website that we found for one version of this, it's called the Breathe Easy. I'm not receiving any funding from them, but I want to be sure you get the right device and don't try to repurpose something intended for another indication. Breathe Easy, B-R-E-A-T-H-E, Easy, spelled in English. And then it's, the website is www.breatheeasy.com. Not expensive. Got some science behind it. I'm thinking that you should always wash things out. And this goes for snorkels or anything that might be kicking around in the garage that you're going to put in your mouth and breathe through. Those things, you need to be sure they're clean before you use them. Deborah in Santa Cruz writes, pregnancy, COVID, and ivermectin. My daughter has COVID. She is 14 and a half weeks pregnant. Her husband is a long hauler with COVID. He got prescribed ivermectin. A friend of hers who is a naturopathic doctor said she could take it at low dosages. I trust your judgment and want to know what you think. Thanks so much. Okay, well, Deborah, I have two problems with this. First of all, ivermectin is contraindicated in pregnancy. It's what we call a category C. And a category C means that if you give it to pregnant mammals, the babies get birth defects. And so we don't really ever want to use that. I found a study that was published in The Lancet that went and looked at all of the case reports of women who were accidentally given ivermectin, because it's used widely in Africa. And I'll come back to that in a moment. It's used for various parasites, and it's quite effective when it's taken as they take it, which is in a burst and not for long periods of time. You don't usually see people on ivermectin for weeks or months. And while in the situation of someone who has long COVID, taking the therapeutic dose of ivermectin for a period to see if they get a response does kind of make sense, because the risk-benefit ratio is there. But we know that for it to be effective for COVID, I believe the dose is like 200 milligrams. It's whatever the husband was given. He got prescribed because his risk-benefit favored that. But we know that at higher doses taken over time, ivermectin does not meet the risk-benefit for a pregnant woman. I understand the fear of COVID. There's a higher risk of problems for the mother in pregnancy. You know, it's terribly stressful if the mother ends up in the intensive care unit on a ventilator. But it's not worth the risk. Making sure that she gets her vitamin D levels up, making sure that she's on some curcumin, maybe the highly absorbable curcumin, 500 milligrams, making sure she's on some quercetin, maybe 800 milligrams of that. These are things we all know to be fine in pregnancy. Ivermectin, we know not to be fine in pregnancy. So I strongly disagree that microdosing it is somehow going to do her any good. So I don't think exposing her fetus to this is a great idea. In fact, I think it's a very bad idea. Enough for that one. And one more, this one from Mona Lisa in Chicago. Mona Lisa writes, fish oil. I really appreciated your recent discussion about using fish oil. I buy large quantities and keep them in the freezer and only take out 1 week supply at a time. Do you think this is a good strategy? Yes, I do. And you know, Mona Lisa, you don't actually have to take it out. I have people take frozen fish oil. It thaws out in your stomach before it gets to where it needs to be. Pretty hot in there, and it'll thaw out. And for people who won't take fish oil because they get fish belch or regurgitation of that smell, it's extremely helpful. So I would just recommend taking them out and popping them when you need them. Okay, so I'm going to move back to science articles now. This is a really important advance, so let's talk about it for a moment. I have to tell you about placenta accreta. Placenta accreta is a medical condition during pregnancy where the placenta gets stuck to the muscle wall. Think about oranges, all right? And you know how some oranges, they're really hard to peel, and you're just picking away at little bits of it because it just sticks there. And other oranges you can just peel off and you can get that fun little circular peel thing that makes you feel all accomplished. Well, the placenta is supposed to act like the second orange. It's supposed to, when the time comes, it's supposed to peel off in one piece and all leave the uterus some 15 minutes after the baby leaves the uterus. If you have placenta accreta, it can stick, or pits of it can stick and tear, and the placenta has a huge blood supply. So now what you have is a hemorrhage. This was one of the most common causes of maternal death at the turn of the 20th century. So back in 1910, 1920, women died, particularly in the pre-World War I years, they died because they were having their fifth or sixth baby and the placenta didn't come out and they bled to death and there wasn't a way to treat them. Any woman who's had a C-section has a slice through her uterus, so she's going to have some scar. She's at an increased risk for this. The more babies you've had, the greater the increase. If you have fibroids, if you've had a D&C, if you have hypertension or you smoke, all of these increase your risk for this. And it's really hard to figure out if a person's at risk for it. Now, we'd love to know ahead of time, just like nowadays we know when the babies breech because we do an ultrasound. That really helps the delivery. Prior to routine ultrasounds, it wasn't really until the cervix dilated and you could get up there with your fingers and you either felt skull or you felt butt. And if you felt butt, well, that was going to be a much riskier birth for that child. So new technology, just fascinating new technology. It's really the tip of the iceberg in terms of these chips that sense things. So what the researchers did was they repurposed a chip that had originally been used to detect tumor cells in people with cancer. You've heard me talk about these cancer blood tests and cancer blood screenings. This is what we're talking about. It's a postage stamp size device. It's got tiny little wires, 1,000 times thinner than a human hair. It's coated with antibodies that recognize specific cells. So the surface markers on the cells, well, these are acting as nanoreceptors at the scale that we were talking about just a few minutes ago. They identified several kinds of cells that would be present at high levels if the placenta was growing into the muscle wall, which is what happens in this disorder. These cells are called tropoblasts, and they start out in the very first days of a pregnancy. This is the part of the fertilized egg that becomes the placenta. If there are lots of tropoblasts in the bloodstream of the mother, that indicates that the placenta has climbed into the muscle, that you have basically a root sticking down into the muscle, not just on the surface of the inside, but going deep. And that root is going to cling so that the placenta tears rather than coming out in one piece. You can see clumps of cells or you can just see an abnormally high number. This device picks it out and it's pretty good. They tested 100 women. The blood test was 79% accurate in confirming it and 93% accurate in ruling it out. So in a woman with a history of any of these other things, a previous cesarean birth, multiparity, multiple babies, in other words, or any of the other risk factors I mentioned, this tool is going to allow those pregnancies to be monitored differently and during delivery. It's going to allow people to be alert that they might have to move to a C-section. They might have to delay delivery until they're ready to do that. And they certainly want that woman coming to the hospital pronto as soon as she feels those first twinges of labor. Because, of course, if it's your fourth or fifth baby, that's going to roll very quickly. So some news on the cancer front now. Published yesterday in the journal Cancer, a new study coming out of the University of Texas shows that statins may improve survival for triple-negative breast cancer patients. Triple-negative breast cancer is an evil version of cancer. of the breast. It is not the most aggressive. That's inflammatory breast cancer. And it's only about 10 to 20% of breast cancer diagnoses. But triple negative means the breast cancer is negative for estrogen receptors, progesterone receptors, and for HER2, which is a compound that leads to an ability to use Herceptin as a therapeutic treatment. Obviously, we can use estrogen blockers if there's estrogen receptors. So we have more tools to fight these cancers. The reason that triple negative breast cancer is triple negative is because the cells have regressed. These are highly aggressive breast cancer cells. They're behaving very much like embryonic cells. It's a tumor that has lost most of the normal control dials and leverage, and it's growing very rapidly, just like early embryonic cells, and taking no prisoners and breaking off and moving through the body. The research looked at women over age 66, and they had 23,000 and change who presented with stage 1 through 3 triple negative breast cancer. Of that group, there were about 2,000 who had been taking statins. They had started a statin within 1 year following their breast cancer diagnosis, or they were already on it at the time of their diagnosis. The statin users were 78% white, 9% black, 8.4% Hispanic, and 4.5% other. It worked across all of these women, especially high-intensity statin use. It had a strong effect on overall survival in women with triple-negative breast cancer. Now, of course, it wasn't just used alone. They had all of the other therapies, including surgical therapies, radiation, chemotherapy, whatever is appropriate for the clinical presentation. Because while the breast cancer is in the breast, how it behaves is very individual from person to person. What they found was a 58% improvement in breast cancer survival at 3.3 years. That's the average length of follow-up in the study. So you could see a 58% improvement in breast cancer-specific survival and a 30% improvement in overall survival with statin use. This is big, okay? This is a big difference. You'll notice that the cancer-specific survival was higher. Well, part of that's because the therapy is pretty brutal, and the therapy creates complications and people can die from their cancer therapy. The other part of it is these women were 66. So when you say overall survival, you're also going to have people who might have had a heart attack or might have been on a statin because they were high risk for a heart attack. So that number for overall survival is also going to show some of the other benefits of the statin, and that's why it's longer. Generally, all-cause mortality and cancer-specific mortality will be different. And, you know, if you have, under most circumstances, all-cause mortality is generally always greater. So another thing in cancer therapy that I found fascinating is researchers in Zurich at a private company have developed a molecule that can be used to tag cancers during surgery. I'll tell you how it was made and what it is. But the idea is that it could be used while the surgeon is operating, and it could be used to show the growing edge of a tumor. So if you were trying to remove all of a breast cancer, for example, sometimes it's a little hard to see where the edge is, and we need to get a good solid margin around the edge of that tumor. So if you could detect growth with a fluorescent object or a fluorescent dye, then you would know exactly where to cut, and that might allow them to take a smaller margin and do less collateral damage to the tissue. So it could be a big step forward. I'm going to take the opportunity to just talk a little bit about collagen. I've been getting lots of questions about collagen supplements from my patients. My answer is yes, I think collagen supplements are good. You have to be really careful with quality. If you're going to eat a beef collagen, you probably want to know whether those beef were grass-fed and what kind of antibiotics and growth factors they were given, because you may get some things along for the ride that you weren't counting on. I tend to prefer fish collagen for most purposes, but if you're taking it for musculoskeletal or bones, you're going to want to get type 1 and type 3 collagen. Getting down to the molecular level, collagen is primarily made up of proline and hydroxyproline as the major components. These are both amino acids, and they're put together in a kind of a grid, and you end up with something that looks like the inside of corrugated cardboards. It's called a beta-pleated sheet. That is the basic structure of collagen, but it's been felted together. And the enzyme that felts it together is something called lipoxygenase, which is also super important in the immune system. It makes the leukotrienes, which are some of the components that cause allergies. All of this stuff is going on throughout the body, and one enzyme will act in multiple different ways in multiple different areas. So what happens with this compound is that it attaches to collagen fibers. Then if a tissue is growing rapidly, you'll see this LOX enzyme, because that's what's used to cause the collagen to cross-link. Remember I said it was felted together. Well, in felt, it's the little bits of wool have little Velcro-like hooks on it, and they molecularly felt together. This is a chemical process cross-linking these strings of collagen to create that corrugated cardboard that's so strong and resistant to stretch. It sort of self-regulates and turns on where there's growth. This could also be used for wound healing. It could be used in many, many research applications. I'm quite excited to see where they take this. Our next story is about strokes. Many years ago, in the early 90s, when I was first doing this program, I came across some research about recovery from strokes. This is back when we're just beginning to learn about neuroplasticity and the idea that in fact, the brain is not fixed and you can get new synapses and you can create new cells. That was thought to not happen in adults. As we discovered that was possible, people began rethinking stroke therapy. Typically, what we would see in medicine is over the first 3 months, we would see most of our recovery. So we would concentrate our physical therapy on that. But physical therapy might amount to an hour, maybe 2 one-hour sessions, if you're lucky, throughout a day. And otherwise, people were pretty much left to themselves and assisted with dressing themselves and everything. Some researchers in the 90s decided that maybe they could exploit neuroplasticity much the way that it's been used in children who have brain injuries, where you would teach them to crawl again by essentially holding their legs and their arms and putting it through a crawling stance and basically using their arms like puppeting them, essentially, and crawling them along the floor until they learned. So they started puppeting adults who had a stroke. So suppose your right arm is gone and you are right-handed. Rather than teaching you to feed yourself with your left arm, they would tie your good arm, your left arm, behind your back, so to speak, and put the spoon in your right arm and then puppet your right arm up to your mouth and feed you so that you were making the movements that would be necessary for feeding yourself. And what they found was that this puppeting worked really well, but it was incredibly time intensive. You actually had to force the brain to grow those new synapses and grow those new cells. And the only way you could do it was by disabling the other side. If you didn't, then the person would devote all their brain neuroplasticity to becoming left-handed rather than right-handed so that they could compensate for their stroke. I had a fantasy about that time. I was spending a lot of time in Indonesia, and I thought, maybe I should start a rehab center here. You know, the people are very respectful of the elderly. It's a beautiful place. Land is relatively cheap. The cost of the assistance wouldn't be high. The licensing is different. So I would be paying people a good solid living wage for their country, but it would be affordable for people from this country. I had this, you know, entrepreneurial fantasy. It never materialized. But the idea would be exactly that. Full-time puppeting. Each person would have a person who fed them, basically using their own arm, walk them, you know, help them learn to use the leg by puppeting their legs. I mean, just the whole concept seemed like it could work, but you'd need 8 hours a day. Well, the use of a robotic exoskeleton during inpatient rehabilitation for acute stroke improves function. This was published in the June 16 Neuro Rehabilitation, and it made a big difference in ambulation. In this study, they took participants. They had 14 people averaging 61. They were receiving inpatient rehab for paralysis caused by a stroke. Their physical therapy sessions had added therapy with a robotic exoskeleton. So they got regular physical therapy that they would ordinarily get, but they also got put into an exoskeleton that would walk them around. You've seen those, you know, one of the silver linings of all of these amputees in the Iraq War and all these spinal injuries is robot walkers. It's sort of like a suit. I remember, I think it's in the second Alien, you see Sigourney Weaver loading, you know, big things in a warehouse wearing effectively a robot. Well, this is a robot walker. People who used the robot exercisers did much better on their walking. They increased their walking distance more rapidly. They had improvements in speed, balance, and endurance, and there were no complications. I think that this is a game changer. The idea of using robot to extend the duration of physical therapy so that we can make real use of that critical period of neuroplasticity. And we now know that if you do it really intensely, this was the research from the 90s, you could take someone who was a year or two out from a stroke, and by being very, very intense in your rehab, you could induce neuroplasticity. But during the acute phases, this worked really well. And in this study, they weren't in the walkers for very long, just a couple of 90-minute segments per day. Imagine what could have been achieved if we'd kept them in the walkers for the 16 hours of being awake every day. Well, I guess we'll find out. See you next week. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.